I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Donald Trump has problems appealing to women voters. An ABC Washington Post poll conducted in June found that 77% of women have an unfavorable view of Trump. Our guest Ann Stone wants to change that. She's a campaign strategist, founder and president of the Stone Group, also one of the founders of a new PAC called Women Vote Trump. She's also chair emeritus of Empowered Women and co-founder of Republicans for Choice. And Ann Stone, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So what is your message to women about why they should vote for Donald Trump?
Well, I love to quote Diamond and Silk, the two African-American sisters who adore him and stump for him all over the country, when they say he's a job creator, he's a motivator, he's a negotiator, and he'll keep us safe. But specifically in terms for women, I would say deeds, not words. We know Donald has problems sometimes with his words, but if you look at what his record is working with women in business, it's unbelievable. He has a record of paying women comparably forever, not for political purposes. Hillary Clinton paid her Senate staff 28% less. Her foundation staff, the women, get paid 38% less. It's only in her campaign now that she finally is paying them comparably. Donald always has. And he gave women opportunities in his industry, which is very male-dominated, you know, decades before it was cool. And his most iconic structure, Trump Tower, as you know, the project was given to a woman. That was unheard of when it happened. He's always shown in business that he has tremendous respect. I actually had him as a client. We did the D.C. market for Trump Air. So I've actually worked with him in a business setting, and he is very respectful, great. Together a team, gives us goals, leaves us alone, lets us do our job, and rewards us handsomely.
Well, I understand the difference between words and deeds, and I think they're also very important. But how do you reconcile, though, the words that he has used or had used as he was running for this nomination? Of course, his disparaging of Carly Fiorina's appearance, what he said to Megyn Kelly after she asked tough questions, has been known to call women disgusting pigs. How do you, though?
Only Rosie.
I know, but who does that? I mean, what adult does that? I'm sorry.
Well, let's put it this way. Donald has made it quite clear. If you attack him, you get it back 10 times worse. In a way, and I know this is going to sound perverse, and some of your listeners are going to go, oh, you've got to be kidding. You know, you want equality? He's treating you equally the same way he does a guy. I mean, you know, he attacks guys just as viciously as he does women. And in a way, it's a backhanded hit at equality. And I know that's sort of a perverse way to look at it. But if you want equality, you have to accept the bad with the good.
You have to accept misogyny, though? You have to accept misogyny?
It isn't misogyny. No. It's not misogyny. It is. He's lashing back just as he does to the guys. And again, you know, now I think Melania and Ivanka have finally convinced him that's got to stop. So it will. But, you know, a lot of the stuff he says, we know. And as women, we know. A lot of the male politicians think this stuff and say this stuff in private. Donald's very upfront, so at least you know what you're getting. And do I excuse it? No. Do I understand it? Unfortunately, I do. And again, I think you'll see, you already have started to see the tone change dramatically.
Well, and I don't want to spend our whole portion on this, but if, let's say, Barack Obama said all those things that Donald Trump said, would that be a disqualifier from your perspective?
No, if he treated men the same. I mean, if this was his personality. And again, remember, a lot of the bad comments were back from his Playboy days, you know, before he was married. And he, you know, said things just like a lot of the guys back then said that I'm sure all of them would like to have disappear. But again, if that was consistent in his personality, that would be one thing. But again, it's important to look at what he actually has done for women as opposed to his words. And his words are bad. Those can be changed easily. I like the fact that he delivers. Another point that I've made consistently, look at how he and Hillary Clinton made their money. Hillary has made millions from giving speeches, speeches that we aren't privy to, most of them as to what she actually said to Wall Street bankers and hedge fund people and all that. So she's made her money by talking. He's made his money by doing, by creating things, by creating jobs, by creating landmark pieces of property. You know, there are people in New York that will tell you he saved New York, some sections of New York, from total ruin. He brought the city back in many ways. You know, the Woolman skating rink story that is now taught in MBA classes and in college, about how he picked up a failed effort by government, spent 6 years and $12 million or something like that to try to renovate a skating rink at Central Park. And he said, listen, let me just take it over. Hmm. And like 3 months and very little money, he got it done. The
but what
the government couldn't do. And they're, you know, so it's stuff like that. Look at what he does.
Can you also look at Atlantic City? And I realize the problems of Atlantic City are larger than Donald Trump, but we've got bankruptcies, we've got failed projects right there. What's the message to voters?
Well, I know something about that because we actually did some work on the opening of the Taj. The message there is the bureaucrats and politicians down there made a lot of promises to the casino people when they came in, Trump and the others. It wasn't just Trump. They talk about graft, corruption, mismanagement. Oh, my God, the government down there was horrible. They destroyed not just Donald's casinos. They destroyed almost all of them. I mean, all the casino industry went south down there, and a lot of it, it's the politicians down there you have to blame. And by the time the bankruptcy started to happen, many of the properties he had already divested because he saw the casino industry was having a problem. So he's a smart businessman. He got out when the getting was good. But do not confuse Chapter 11 with Chapter 7. Chapter 11 simply allows you to reorganize. It preserves most of the jobs. It allows the entity to continue functioning. And most of the creditors do end up getting made whole. Not all, but most.
Well, in fact, we heard from a caller earlier in the hour saying that Donald Trump never paid him or only paid him partially for the work that he did. And there is a bit of a theme there. And I realize he's a real estate businessman, which has its risks associated. But it seems like he's got a bit of a track record when it comes to paying people who have worked for him.
His track record is no worse than any other businessman, really. And again, he was my client. He always paid me, always paid our bills on time, and I have no quarrels at all. So I think you have to look at deeper into what the circumstances were. I mean, as a businesswoman, I've started several companies, and I've had cases where we're in dispute with creditors, and I have creditors that probably say that about us. But if you delve into the details, you find out either they didn't perform or there were other things going on that, you know, double billings or who knows what else. So you can't take things at face value. Mm. A businessman, if they've done a lot of work, is always going to have somebody that's going to, you know, be ready to say, oh, you know, blah, blah, blah about them. But when you look into it, sometimes it isn't always what it first appeared. So I would just say, you know, delve deeper and don't just take things at face value. He's easy to take shots at. He sets himself up for it. And as a businessman with a lot of businesses, I mean, he's associated with like 500 entities. Not all, you know, most of them he licenses name or whatever, but, you know, others, of course, there's going to be instances where you can point to this or that.
Should he release his tax returns, though? So we can see how he has made his money?
I think he will. I think you already have that because you have the financial statements that he already issued early on. And I think he will. But remember, Mitt Romney, who called for this, I want to smack him. If I could see him face to face, I would just slap him across his silly face.
Why is that?
The man did not release. Well, because he didn't release his tax returns until, like the end of September. And here he is, you know, high and mighty telling Donald Trump, you know, how dare you not release your tax returns, blah, blah, blah. Well, buddy, you didn't do it either. And I mean, unbelievable hypocrisy.
Well, as you know, the big story this morning is Melania Trump's speech last night. NPR looked at the words that Melania Trump spoke last night in Cleveland for the Republican convention and actually compared to the speech that Michelle Obama gave in 2008 to the Democratic convention.
Yep.
And they found in 1 minute that the words were identical, raising the questions of plagiarism. What do you think about that?
Right. Well, isn't that sad? Isn't it sad? And I think we'll, as the day goes on, we're going to find out more about, I think she wrote most of her speech. They probably had a speechwriter tweak it. you know, did somebody stick stuff in there? But if you look at the words and the couple of sentences, and it's really only a couple sentences out of a very long speech, it's the kind of words all of us would use, talking about, you know, hard work and what that means and being rewarded.
Yeah, but we're talking word for word in many instances.
I understand. No. I understand. So I'm saying if she looked at it, if a speechwriter added some stuff or whatever and she looked at it, of course it would reflect what she thinks, and it's the way all of us would probably say it. So I think we'll find out more, but we're talking about a couple lines out of a very long speech. So to me, it's much ado about nothing. These are not words that Michelle Obama invented, because if you look at the words and the phrases, they're things that all of us use all the time. I mean, her words are, you probably find a speech I've given and thousands of speeches I've given over the years where I've said probably about the same thing as well. Maybe not quite as word for word.
I was going to say, this is pretty word for word.
I don't deny.
Okay.
Right. But it's, again, one little part of a longer speech.
And let me get, and as you know, this is blowing up all over the media this morning.
Let
me get Meredith from Malvern to join us before we have to say goodbye to you. And Meredith, you've been hanging on. I want to just give you a chance to have your say. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've been thinking that what I haven't been hearing is that here Melania gave her speech and surely her husband and the speechwriter looked it over, and if either one or both of them did, she was really hung out to dry, and that is not a to suffer the consequences of the plagiarism, and that's not a good barometer of either his party or the people who are supporting him, their integrity and their character. Donald Trump's character. He's even willing to let his wife talk, say a speech that was okay, that would get this attention.
Well, Meredith, I appreciate the call. I know you were hanging on. And Stone, let me give you a chance to respond. We have to say goodbye in about a minute.
Well, yeah, I was going to say I wouldn't tag this on Donald Trump. It's going to probably end up being a speechwriter if, in fact, they determine that that was done. I think what happened is she started a draft, or they started a draft. She looked at it, and she crafted her own stuff. These are words that she probably wouldn't, I don't see her Googling a speech and inserting words from a speech. So I think this is likely, somebody else's work. But again, look at the entire speech. It's a long speech. We're talking about, you said, within a minute. So it's a very small part of the overall speech. And if the speechwriter stuck that stuff in, it's sad. Now, there's one positive. If, in fact, she endorses those words, which she did, then that means that they and the Obamas share some values. And won't it be nice if both sides can mean those values, because they are core American values. So I think the positive is good if they share the values. I think that's good for America.
Well, I wish we could talk more. Maybe we'll catch up with you later in the season. Ann Stone, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Co-founder of the PAC Women Vote Trump, also co-founder of Republicans for Choice. Didn't have a chance to ask her about the platform coming out of Cleveland. We have three guests waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Women, African American, Latinos, and other minorities are playing a key role this presidential election season and will be well into the future. After the 2012 loss, the GOP did an autopsy concluding they had to be more welcoming of minorities and women. Looks like with the apparent nomination of Donald Trump, the party has a way to go to appeal to these voters. We have three guests who have joined us in the final sections of Radio Times today. Debbie Walsh is director of the Center for American Women and Politics. That's a unit of the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University. Debbie Walsh, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks to be back.
Nice to have you back. Kalia Brown-Dean is with us as well, associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University. And Kalia, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
And she's joining us by Skype, I should add. And also with us is Doyle McManus, Washington columnist for the Los Angeles Times. And Doyle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be with you, and I'm joining you from Cleveland.
There you go. Well, thank you for doing that. Debbie, let me begin with you, only because we just said goodbye to Anne Stone just founded a PAC to get women to vote for Trump. And this is a PAC that just got started. They're having some struggles on getting supporters. Yeah. But it looks like Donald Trump has a serious problem with women, something like 60, 70% of women saying that they have an unfavorable rating, feeling or feeling for Donald Trump. Is it because of things that he has said over the last year?
I think it's things he's said over the last year and for quite a while, and I think it's some of the positions that he's taken. I think it's important to remember that in general, the gender gap, which is something that we have seen since 1980, is the difference between the way men and women vote and support candidates. And we have historically, since 1980, seen that women are more likely to support the Democratic candidate than men and less likely than men to support the Republican candidate. So this is following a pattern, but it is more accentuated this year. And it has been, as you mentioned, something that the Republican Party has been trying to figure out how to do, how to narrow that gap, how to take out some of that advantage that Democrats have with women voters. And certainly we are not seeing, as of right now, that Donald Trump has been the candidate to do that.
Kalila, let me go to you. And I'm looking at a TV screen. I'm looking at two monitors here. And what are people talking about? Melania Trump's speech last night and whether she plagiarized from Michelle Obama. There's a fair amount of finger-pointing going on. What do you make of both the speech and the reaction to it?
Well, I think that so much of the speech was predicated on this idea that Obama has been horrible for the country, that the Obamas go against American values. And so you heard it from your previous guest that obviously there's a lot more in common between these two families than perhaps Trump would have given them credit for. But it also strikes a chord with voters who feel overlooked by the Trump candidacy to say, wait a minute, this is unacceptable. Put politics aside, put party aside. If your speech is about responsibility, then own up to this and claim it. That's the only way you can get voter support.
Doyle, is imitation then this what is it, sincerest form of flattery?
Well, I suppose you could say that, although in this case, it really was shoddy speech writing work. People will be able to debate whether it counts as plagiarism or not. But it's clear that, number one, Melania Trump didn't write her speech and nobody expected her to. But number two, whoever the professional was who wrote the speech should have done a better job. Yeah. And if a convention is supposed to be, these days, a first-rate infomercial for the candidate, this one isn't quite first rate so far. It's a very rocky start.
Well, you're there in Cleveland. How, though, has the first day played with the delegates?
Delegates you talk to, because, of course, the afternoon of day one, the part that the 99% of Americans would not have bothered to see on their TV screen was, in fact, the last stand of the Trump movement. The delegates,
you know what, Doyle? I hate to do this to you, only because your phone line is not terrific. We're going to call you back and hope to get you back on a better line. And he is Doyle McManus, joining us from Cleveland, Washington columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Debbie Walsh and Kalila Brown-Dean staying with us as we talk more about the campaign season so far this year. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kalila, what are conventions for these days? Yes, there was some floor fights yesterday afternoon in Cleveland, but I think we pretty much know, barring some unforeseen circumstance, that Donald Trump will be the Republican nominee. Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee. So what are conventions for?
Well, traditionally, conventions become pep rallies for the party to, you know, bring out all the celebrities you can, the musicians, but it's also a preview of rising stars within the party. We saw that a little bit last night with Congressman Joni Ernst's speech to the convention. The timing of her speech, however, goes against the traditional mode within conventions, because you want people to see this is the person that we're looking toward as a Republican Party leader a year down the road, maybe 4 years. That's what helps then Senator Barack Obama be viewed as a national political figure. The timing and structure of this week's convention goes against that traditional grain.
Go ahead, Debbie.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say another, I think that's absolutely right, and I think another aspect of conventions is there are sort of these key points in time over the course of a campaign where candidates have an opportunity to reach out to what we would consider sort of the inattentives, although I think this year the inattentives are a fairly small group. But it's a chance to really, with where you get to control the whole thing, you know, you're not responding to questions from journalists, you're controlling the agenda, to put out a message and a story to those inattentive voters to kind of get them engaged. The conventions are one. The first presidential debate is another. It really is a chance to engage them. And I think regardless of where all of this comes out with this issue of this speech and the plagiarism, what's happened is the entire first day has now become coverage of that.
Right.
And that is what is the takeaway. So anything that they thought might have been positive out of last night, and I was at the convention, and anything that, you know, the energy that was there for some of the speeches, I think has now been completely overtaken. And so what you're watching is all of the chatter is about is the folks from the Trump campaign having to defend this in some way.
Doyle, let me go back to you. Hopefully we have you on a better line. And I was watching the convention last night, and there certainly was a message about making America safe again. Talk about, I know you cover immigration, but talk about the numbers of people who could said that they had family members who were killed by illegal immigrants. We heard from victims of about Benghazi and what happened a couple of years ago when four Americans were killed. It was a very strong message about this dangerous world and that we should be afraid.
That's exactly right. It was about a dangerous world, and the theme was Hillary Clinton and the Democrats will make it even more dangerous. At one point during the day, Newt Gingrich, the former Speaker of the House, said that Democratic candidates stand for unemployment and physical danger.
Wow.
And that was kind of a stark way of putting it. What was puzzling to me was it seemed to me that was all preaching to the choir. It was great red meat stuff for Republican voters, for Donald Trump voters who already despise Hillary Clinton and the Democrats. I'm not sure it did much to reach out to the voters in the middle, the undecideds, the independents, which are really the people Donald Trump needs to pick up at this point.
Doyle, are you saying they needed more Ronald Reagan and less Richard Nixon?
Exactly. They needed, and there are an awful lot of conventional...
this is so frustrating. What can I say? Doyle, we're going to give you one more shot. It's not your problem. It's whoever's running the phone system in this country. My perennial complaint, Doyle McManus. We're going to try to hook him up again from Cleveland. But Kalila Brown-Dean staying with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Debbie Walsh is in Cleveland, and she's Director of the Center for American Women in Politics, and that's at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And you can join us by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kalila, one of the speakers, and there were some B, C list actors speaking last night, a guy named Antonio Sabato Jr., who said that Barack Obama was absolutely a Muslim. There was also Scott Baio saying that it's time to make America America again. There was a bit of a subtext about, I guess, getting our country back, but that has a kind of racialized overtone.
Well, I think it was particularly striking to hear from people who are either immigrants or the direct descendants of immigrants, first generation Americans, to make this claim about making America, America again. Because you hear that rhetoric and the question is always, well, what is that America that you envision? Who is involved in that? Who was necessary to make that vision possible? And how do you go forth? That kind of rhetoric is damaging because the reality is that Donald Trump cannot win in November just with Republican voters. Hillary Clinton can't win just with Democratic voters. You have to incorporate people with the message that says your policy positions, regardless of identity politics, your policy positions can be accounted for. You heard that with the father of Jamil Shaw, the 17-year-old who was killed in California. And to have an African-American father say, I don't care about the race of Barack Obama. I care about the leader who's going to make my family feel safe again. That's where you have to focus without the sort of dog whistle claims of Antonio Sabato, who became famous really as an underwear model about Barack Obama's fate.
Fair enough. But I wonder, Debbie, and this is looking ahead, obviously conventions are about uniting the party. But if you demonize the other person, and I think the Democrats have to be careful of this as well when they're in Philly next week, but if you demonize the other party, then you make it almost impossible for whoever the next president is to be an effective leader of the country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the tone and the tenor that this campaign could take and already has taken has, you know, great potential to damage whoever is the winner of this race. But I actually want to go back a little bit to what you were just talking about, because I think that there's the kind of the underlying or not so underlying racism that we hear. And then there is a sexism that we hear, and I think that is part of what is driving some of the concern that women have about Donald Trump. So you remember earlier on, he made some comments about women have it better, you can't say anything anymore. And I think that dog whistle racism that was just referred to is there's a piece of that that's also about sexism, that the idea of make America great again, you know, we've heard it being talked about as make America white again, but also make it America where men were in charge again. And so I think you hear both of those things. And I think women voters are uncomfortable with this. And I think one of the things that we've really noticed is that, you know, the group of women that have been kind of marginally in the middle where they kind of go, they can go Republican or they can go Democrat, have been married women. And right now, Hillary Clinton is doing much better with married women than Barack Obama or did back in 08 or in 2012. So, you know, I think that Donald Trump, you know, as was just mentioned, you know, he cannot win with just Republican voters. He also cannot win with just angry white male voters. And the message he needs to get out to try to reach others, so far we're not hearing it.
Doyle, we have you back. My fingers are crossed. And I see an email from Tess, and she says, I'm more disturbed by the subgroup comment from last night. This was Representative Steve King. He was on Chris Hayes' show on MSNBC and made a comment that frankly shocked everyone sitting around the table, saying that, you know, the United States and Western civilization is the reason that we are where we are, basically dismissing any other civilization or any other part of the world for any of the contributions that they have made to our country or, frankly, to the rest of the world. Now, he is Steve King, but what do you make of those comments?
Well, yes, the first thing to say is he is Steve King, the congressman from Iowa, who has a long history of making some of the most outrageous and offensive remarks of anybody alive in American politics today. But here's the problem, and I'm going to quote Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, who did a session with reporters yesterday in Cleveland. And he said this is an issue that divides the Republican Party in ways that we haven't seen yet because it hasn't really bubbled up. But Paul Ryan hit it head on. He asked about the kind of rhetoric that we were hearing, not Steve King in particular. And he said one of the things that worries him most is that identity politics, the politics that basically says this party is for you because you are white or you're African-American or you're Latino, that we used to be able, as Republicans, he said, to say that's something the Democrats do. We don't do it. He said, I'm beginning to see that now in the Republican Party and the conservative movement. And if you unpack that, he's saying we're in danger, Republicans, of becoming the party of white males. And that's both bad politics and bad morality.
Did he go one step further and say because of some of the things that Donald Trump has said? Or he left that unsaid?
He left unsaid who it was who was using divisive rhetoric. But there was no question that he was talking about some of the things Donald Trump has said.
And we've been focusing a lot on women. But, Doyle, I know because you cover this, and the autopsy of a couple of years ago said that the Republican Party has to be more welcoming to Latinos. George Bush got about 40% of the Latino vote, and it's been falling ever since. Just how important are Latinos this year, and obviously beyond, but certainly this year?
Well, they are hugely important this year, and even more important, they will be bigger every election cycle in our lifetimes to come. And so this is where, to me, the stakes in this campaign for the Republican Party aren't just whether Donald Trump wins the White House this time or not, even though that's obviously a huge stake right there. It's whether the Republican Party is going to turn off the biggest minority group in American politics. Mm-hmm. And look, here's the number. This year, Latinos, Hispanics, will reach a record number of 12% of eligible voters, that is to say citizens 18 years and older. That means for the first time they are equal in size to African Americans. But the difference is that the Latino population is growing. The African American population is not growing disproportionately. In years to come, they will be a much larger share. And Donald Trump and the Republican Party are doing a pretty good job right now of losing that group. The most recent polling is all over the map in terms of what Trump's appeal is as a candidate. It's not strong. The argument is over how weak it is. But only 12% of American Latinos identify themselves as Republicans. That's really bad.
And that's Doyle McManus, Washington columnist for the Los Angeles Times, on a much better line. Also with us, Kalila Brown-Dean. She's associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University, and Debbie Walsh, director of the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. Much more to talk about after this very short break, and you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are talking about the Republican National Convention taking place in Cleveland. Today is day two. How soon we forget. Day one was a very busy day. And our guests are Kalila Brown-Dean, Debbie Walsh, and Doyle McManus. Let me get Mark from Powelton Village to join our conversation. Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey. I think you guys are missing the boat on this Melania Trump thing. The phrase "my word is my bond" is coded African American slang, from what my African American friends tell me, and it was used by African American couples in the 19th century in lieu of wedding vows when they were married while enslaved. So when Melania Trump used those words last night, every African-American woman who was watching went, "Ooh, you go, girl." And then they started.
Well, I don't know. Mark, I don't know if they said that exactly, but let me find out what Kalila thinks. Kalila, go ahead.
Well, as an African-American woman, I don't use the phrase "you go, girl." And I certainly didn't respond that way last night. But it is clear how that phrase has evolved over time. Even within hip hop culture, it's used as "word is bond," as a way of saying when you have nothing else, all you have is your word. Mm. You see it in other forms of pop culture, like the series The Wire. But what I think, you know, bringing all of this together, what is key is to hear Paul Ryan say, we are becoming a party that only appeals to a particular base. The question I always ask as a social scientist is the why. And now what do you do? So as we're having this conversation, the state of Virginia is battling a voting rights case that will disenfranchise thousands of African American and Latino voters. It is a case that was brought by the Republican Party because of concerns over how these demographic changes would turn into political consequences. That's where we have to bring these things together.
Well, and just to underscore what you just said there, Kalila, is that there have been all sorts of voting regulations. Some have been passed here in Pennsylvania. They did not pass, but certainly in the last couple of years, that's been such a salient issue.
Very much so. And to think that here we are 50 years after the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, this will be the first presidential election in 50 years where the key protections of that act are not in place because of a Supreme Court decision a few years ago and states supporting that. So again, it's important to look at the numbers of who may be eligible in theory. But if we look at what's happening at the state level and the local level, it is rolling back the progress that people of all political backgrounds thought we had made.
Let me read a couple of comments. An email from Tib. I think the media did the public a disservice by concentrating so much on Melania's plagiarized passages when they could and should have been spending more time on the protests by the GOP delegates who opposed Trump. We actually began our show by talking about that. Email from Jill. I don't feel a bit bad for Melania Trump. She threw her lot in with that animal. Buyer beware. An email from Joseph. You need to be discussing, we already did, discussing Steve King. Generally, the conservative side will say not Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, but last night it was Blue Lives Matter, so which is it? And on and on and on. Facebook comment from James, you can't win a presidential election with just angry white men. And do all that, I think that's something that you were saying. I mean, that's just a demographic truth, it seems to me.
That's right. And Republican strategists and even Paul Manafort, who is Donald Trump's campaign manager, all say that what he has to do if he's going to win is he has to reach out to precisely the populations we are talking about, not only to African-Americans, not only to Latinos, but also, interestingly, to Asian-Americans, who are a group that were once defined or stereotyped as natural Republicans in the making. But in the 2012 election, they voted for Barack Obama in numbers like Latinos did. And they have to figure out a way to reach out to women. And they have not done any of those things. And if we're talking about coded language from Melania Trump, look, Donald Trump's problem is bigger, so big, he doesn't need coded language. He needs clear language. There were a couple of polls out. I think one of them was in Pennsylvania that showed that Donald Trump is polling at 0% among African Americans. And that is a modern record. And coded language isn't going to fix that.
Debbie, let me go to you. I know you want to weigh in on this as well. And just to focus a little bit more on women and even looking ahead to Philadelphia next week when it looks like Hillary Clinton will be the nomination. Is that, I mean, we had our first Black president. There's a possibility we'd have our first woman president. Mm-hmm. Is that an issue that matters to women in this country?
I think it matters to women, but I think the what we do know about the women's vote is not about the gender of the candidate. It really has come down to the party. And we know that women feel more economically vulnerable than men do. They make less money than men. They are more likely to need that social safety net at some point in their lives, whether it's Social Security or unemployment. And they support the party that they are more likely to support the party that supports that social safety net, which is the Democratic Party. And so figuring out, you know, when we look at this gender gap right now, we're seeing that Donald Trump, we looked at an aggregate of polls for the last 5 weeks, and we see Donald Trump getting about 34% of the women's vote. You know, the last time that a Republican nominee won with less than, you know, got less than 40% of the women's vote was when Bob Dole got 38% of it back in 1996. Donald Trump has a long way to kind of dig out from the hole that he's in, and I think one of the perfect examples of the challenge that he faces is Susan Collins, the moderate Republican senator from Maine, who is actually entertaining publicly the possibility of voting for Hillary Clinton. She's not sure she will, but she is also saying, I may write somebody in. She does say, you know, there's always room for redemption. That's her word. And so if he can't get the women in the United States Senate, all of them who are Republican, to support him, what does that mean looking out to more moderate Republican women around the country, whether they will vote for Hillary Clinton or whether they will just not pull a lever for president or write someone else in. He has a challenge ahead of him to make some inroads in that vote. So that's really on him, on him at this point.
And Kalila, I know oftentimes platforms are overstated in terms of their importance and whether whoever the candidate is, whether that is really their playbook as they're running for office. But when you look at the platform coming out of the Republican convention, no exceptions for abortion, including things like rape and a woman's health. When it comes to abortion rights, there's also questions about rolling back pretty much all the rights that LGBT people in this country have gotten over the last couple of years. Is this a risky thing, do you think, for the Republican Party, or is it just something you give to some more conservative parts of the party, let them write it, and then move on from there?
I think it's definitely risky because with all of our focus, rightfully so, on the presidential election, there are key races at the local and state level as well, where you see these sort of down ticket effects. So what can't be accomplished at the national level becomes a signal for states to pick up that mantle and run with it. So it's incredibly dangerous to realize the groups that you need to incorporate into the party and to choose these platforms and a vice presidential running mate that really antagonizes those groups. To think about, you know, wanting to remove the restriction on churches and nonprofits so that they cannot publicly endorse or oppose a candidate. That's not just about party. That's about First Amendment. So we can't say the Second Amendment is sacred and then be so willing to erode the First, the Fourth, the Eighth, and other parts of the Constitution.
Doyle, you want to weigh in on this at all?
I'm going to weigh in, though, and say in a year when Donald Trump is the candidate with the enormously strong, to put it mildly, strong personality and ferocious rhetoric that he brings to this, I think the platform will largely be forgotten a few weeks from now. And what is really going to matter this week, for the rest of this week, after the rocky start of this convention, everything rests on Donald Trump's speech on Thursday. That's an enormous opportunity for him to somehow enlarge his base of support. Whether he can take advantage of that opportunity or not, so far you'd have to say the indications are we're not going to see a new Trump. It's going to be the same old Trump. But I think, if anything, the stakes for that particular speech on Thursday evening are now much higher than they were at the beginning of the week.
Let me get Bob from Wilmington, Delaware, to join us. Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So, let me respond to what he just said about nobody will care about the platform. I was disappointed, by the way, it took you as long as it did to finally get around the platform discussion. But I got to tell you, people do care about the platform. And it's up to the news media to sit down with Donald and say, so, Donald, tell us about, the gay life. Tell us about what you're going to do with abortion. Tell us what you're going to do about this stuff. And keep him on the record for these things. Because the platform does make a difference. Him being a charismatic orange-haired leader is fine, but the Republicans are all campaigning on the platform. That's why it's there. And I think it's up to the news media to say, tell us more about the platform, and walk away from, oh, Mulaney, you took 25 words from Michelle. Nobody cares about her speech. They care about the issues.
Fair enough, Bob. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give all of you a chance to respond. Debbie, what do you say back to Bob?
Well, I think the platform does matter. I do, but I do think that most people don't pay that much attention to it. But it does matter because it is the philosophy that both parties then work with and are based on. So it reflects the values of the party, and it reflects the direction. But I think the reality is that most voters don't pay that much attention to it.
Kalila, I hear embedded in Bob's question is the press doing a good enough job of holding Donald Trump accountable for the things that he has said, for the policy platforms coming out of the party as well? What do you think about that?
Well, I think it's a valid critique. And I think that this election year, Trump as a candidate has been so sensational and so out of the norm that it's hard not to get caught in that personality factor. But what I think is if we move beyond November, take Trump out of the equation, there will still be a large base of people in this country who hold those views, who were drawn to those kinds of points in that rhetoric. That's where we have to start addressing. The Republican Party has to start asking itself, why? Why were people so drawn to these ideas, not just this personality? And the media has to keep asking the question of how. If your goal is to make immigration a more efficient system, how are you going to do it? That's where we have to hold everyone accountable.
How about for you, Doyle?
Well, I'm going to say that Bob is exactly right, that the media have to keep holding Donald Trump accountable. My prediction, incidentally, is in the first interview in which he's asked, do you agree 100% with your platform on issues like abortion and gay rights? He'll say no. Part of his weird genius is that his views are so malleable, he lets you read into Donald Trump whatever you think. But the platform does matter, certainly in this sense. You started out by talking about the autopsy of 2013, in which the Republican Party as an institution decided that it had to make its tent bigger, that it had to appeal to new groups of voters. And what we're seeing in that platform is that as an institution at the moment, the Republican Party is moving in precisely the opposite direction.
Doyle, you had an interesting piece or observation, which is when you look at what we call the Latino vote, that people who are Puerto Rican or Mexican American or Dominican American don't necessarily identify with that word Latino. Can you expand on that?
Sure. Actually, traditionally, Latinos didn't call themselves Latinos. They called themselves Mexican Americans or Puerto Ricans, or they identified themselves by their nationality. But to me, one of the most amazing and interesting findings of the last 10 years of our immigration debate, and it's even more so in the Trump campaign, is that this contestation over the issue is driving Latinos together. An increasing number of Latinos are saying, of Mexican Americans are saying, yes, I have things in common with Puerto Ricans and with Dominicans and all the way across the board. So in a strange sense, the heat of this issue, in which Latinos of different nationalities have felt themselves under the same what sounds to be disdain from the white, from elements in the non-Latino white community, it is creating a Latino group identity that didn't really exist before.
Debbie, I'm going to give you the last question. We've been focusing on women because of your obvious area of expertise. How about millennials? And they have been in many ways supportive of Bernie Sanders. There were, of course, questions 8 years ago whether women who supported Hillary would go for Barack Obama. How do you see millennial women and the role they play this year?
You know, I think that's interesting, and it's been such a topic of conversation about the millennial women and where were they, and they were more likely to be with Bernie Sanders this time around. But if we've just, the Pew Research Center just did a kind of over time look at the race in 08, in 2012, and now in 2016 at this point in time. And actually, right now, Hillary Clinton is doing as well, if not a little bit better, with young women and with young men. So I think that at the end of the day, those millennials who will come out and vote will probably mirror pretty much what we've seen in the past two election cycles.
Well, we have to end our conversation. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Debbie Walsh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Director of the Center for American Women in Politics, and that's a unit of the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University. Kalila Brown-Dean, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. And she joined us by Skype, and she's the Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. And Doyle McManus, I'm glad we put you on Skype so we could hear you, and thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, and thanks to your engineers for persisting.
Yeah, we are persistent here on Radio Times, and he's Washington columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Madison Poulter, our intern for today's edition of Radio Times, Kevin Griffin, our engineer, and our hats off to Kevin. Always there, the man I stare at for 2 hours every morning. And Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.